This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Saul Gonzalez of KQED's The California Report, in for Steve Chiatakis this week. Let's do a little grocery shopping, and we're starting off in the bread and bakery section of a Sprouts in LA's Palms neighborhood. Okay, I got a loaf of Oro wheat bread, some mission tortillas for taco night later this week, of course, and I'm not sure we can leave without some Entenmann's, say, chocolate cakes. You might not think about it on your grocery shopping trip, but lots of these baked goods are made in Southern California. Yeah, there's still plenty of that kind of manufacturing that goes on around here. Right now, all this stuff gets baked in giant commercial ovens. Ovens that are big polluters. I know, suddenly that chocolate cake is sounding a lot less tasty. But soon, here in Southern California, many of the ovens that do that industrial scale baking will go electric. Good news for the planet. KCRW's Kaylee Wells joins me now to talk about this. Hey, Kaylee.
Hey, Saul.
So how many loaves of bread and sweets in these larger ovens are we talking about that are made every day?
Well, it's probably a lot more than you think. It's not even close to the oven that you've got in your kitchen. And really, it's not even close to the oven in the Italian restaurant down the street, because those might be making a couple hundred loaves of bread per day. These ovens are making a couple hundred loaves of bread per minute.
That's amazing.
I know. It kind of blows my mind. They're machines that are so big, they need their own written permit from our local air district. And there's 218 of these places in Southern California. Some of the ones you might know, the Cheesecake Factory Bakery in Calabasas. There's Bimbo Bakeries, which is in the eastern San Fernando Valley. And that's the company that's making Sara Lee bagels, Thomas English muffins, the little bites from Entenmann's, those things that you might recognize in your grocery store bakery section.
And why the change now from ovens that use methane gas to electric ovens?
Well, because we've seen this aggressive zero emissions push in other sectors like, you know, transportation. You know that in 12 years, you won't be able to buy a new gas car here, for example. But we haven't seen that kind of push in the industrial sector until now.
This is the first zero emission standard in the country for an industrial source.
That's Adrian Martinez with Earth Justice. And he's saying this is the first time in the U.S. that any factory in the industrial sector has been told you have got to completely stop emitting greenhouse gases, not just like clean up your operations in some way. And he said industrial sources like these ovens make up a quarter of methane emissions.
One of the places we're starting in California is food and beverage manufacturing. And that makes sense because California has the largest number of food and beverage manufacturing facilities in the country.
So the reason this rule is a big deal is it shows that we can make sustainable standards in the industrial sector, even somewhere like LA that has hundreds of these machines. And so the hope is that this is just the first step toward making more zero emissions rules in the industrial sector.
Yeah, but you know, compared to everything else that's spewing pollutants into the air, how big of an impact is this really going to have in the fight against smog and climate change?
Yeah, I mean, okay, not huge. The first phase of this rule was actually already in effect, and if you step outside your apartment and you take a deep breath on a smoggy day, you're probably not going to look around and think, wow, the decrease in the commercial oven emissions is making my lungs feel so much better. So Sara Reese with South Coast Air Quality Management District, which those are the people who approved the rule, they said they didn't start here because it would make the biggest difference in LA smog. It's more because it was low-hanging fruit. It's just not that difficult to imagine an electric oven because, for example, I've got one in my apartment right now.
In general, it's a relatively small segment of the NOx emissions in our basin, but it's one area where we're starting. You know, it's easier to look at this for commercial ovens. We already know on the residential side, there are electric ovens, so that type of technology is available.
And so rather than being important to your lungs, it's kind of more important symbolically, because now you have the AQMD saying, any place we can reduce emissions, we will. And that attitude should make a difference over time as they keep making these rules.
But I gotta think there is going to be strong opposition to this. I assume the ovens are pricey, and I can't imagine the folks who make, say, mission tortillas or See's candies are really thrilled to be buying all these new machines.
That's what I expected too, but they're actually not as unhappy as you might think.
Actually, we think it's a very reasonable rulemaking and a very stepwise process.
So that's Rosma Zvonners with a trade group called the American Bakers Association. And she says at first the rule was going to be more strict, but officials have backed off because adapting for these companies is going to be like a capital P process.
So, for example, in some cases, it was estimated that each bakery may need 5 times more electricity to continue its operations.
And that doesn't even include all of the upgrades to the infrastructure to get all of that extra electricity to the machines. So the rule doesn't actually apply until an oven reaches 10 years old, and then the actual zero emissions requirement doesn't kick in for some of this equipment until 2027, which is when we will actually start to see those fully electric ovens.
So when it comes to me, an eater of many things, I can eat my cake without guilt now.
Well, okay, maybe not guilt about your climate impact, but they're still not going to become a healthy food group all of a sudden. So I can't absolve you of your diet guilt just yet.
That is a whole different conversation about diet guilt. All right, we've been talking to KCRW's Kaylee Wells. Kaylee, thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime, Saul.
And coming up, think Coachella, and you might think of a hip annual music festival, but it's also one of the country's breadbaskets, and a lot of the local farm workers there are poor and work in terrible conditions. We'll talk to people trying to help. That's just ahead on Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA, from heat waves to torrential rains, it's been a year of extreme weather here in Southern California. And for farm workers in the Coachella Valley, that's meant putting up with brutal working conditions in the fields or going without work altogether. That's what happened last weekend when Tropical Storm Hillary tore through the region, leaving rows of crops waterlogged and muddy. Thankfully, a few groups are trying to help the workers.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy.
Oh, baby, I can buy a little help for my pain. All I need is my brother. Buy a little help for my pain.
Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
For 3 years, a coalition of nonprofits and mutual aid groups have regularly distributed fresh food to Coachella Valley farm workers. It's a way to make sure the folks who are feeding us get fed, too. Millie Trevino-Sauceda is executive director of Alianza Nacional de Campesinas, and Melissa Acedera is director of Polo's Pantry, and they're here to tell us more. Hello to both of you.
Hi.
Hello.
Millie, I'm going to start with you. Can you talk more about your organization's work and how it got started, briefly?
We started organizing with farm worker women since the late 80s, and we organized statewide with Líderes Campesinas, which is a statewide organization of farm worker women being the ones making the decisions and being the ones to decide what are the issues and how they can take care of them. And then this organization, Líderes Campesinas, was the one that built the National Alliance of Farm Worker Women, which is Alianza Nacional de Campesinas. So we focus on farm worker women issues, poverty, immigration issues, labor issues, and violence against women.
So like in the next, say, in the past week, what have you been doing in light of these storms, for instance? What's like some real world work you've been doing to help farm workers?
Well, many things. Farmer girl families already live under the poverty line level. People are renting homes, are renting trailers, are renting as much as they can, and sometimes they're living in conditions that are, you know, just several families living together. And then the disaster, you know, because of the all these trees falling because of what happened with all this rain and wind and flooding, it just created even more anxiety and more issues, more problems. So Alianza, along with Food Forward, along with Polo's Pantry, along with Volunteers in Medicine and other groups, we were able to put together volunteers to help out, bring food to our families. But we go to their doors. We don't expect just to come to a place where we do food distribution. We even rent U-Hauls to help them out.
Got it. Okay, Melissa, let's talk about your group. Your pantry is, I believe, based here in Los Angeles, and you're most synonymous with work on Skid Row. What led you out to the Coachella Valley to try to help people there?
My base actually, yes, started as working around unhoused food systems, right, in Skid Row. I, as a food activist and sort of organizer, our farm workers are the backbone of our food system. So it doesn't make sense for us working in the system, even if it's, you know, even if, you know, Coachella Valley is a ways away. I think it was important for us to also highlight the work that's being done out there. The people who are picking and growing our food themselves cannot afford to take care of themselves and their families. And so I felt like organizing and this food distribution with Millie and her teams in the Deres and Alianza has been very important for us to continue to have that awareness. For us, for those of us who benefit from the work that they do, to understand the real conditions that are happening for them. We've actually had high school students, we had law students from UCLA come out, you know, and help us at the distributions for the last few years. And it's been very great because it's great for people, young people especially, to fully understand, right, the scope of what our farm workers do for us.
Sure, absolutely. And Millie, can I go back to you? Can you talk about the situation there right now in Coachella Valley in the wake of this storm? It was only a week ago that we had this tropical storm system go through, a lot of flooded fields, a lot of flooded roads. How are people doing right now, the people that you're working with and help?
Yes, some of the farm worker families, there are members, their homes were damaged. The roads are still closed in some areas where they have to go around miles and miles to be able to get to their work. And there was some work, you know, there was no work at the time. And at the same time, there's been houses that have been flooded, mobile home parks, which I call them labor camps, because they're all beat up trailers that are being rented to these families. Some homes were damaged because some of the trees fell over them. Some of the places were just flooded altogether. Everything was damaged. The little things or furniture that people had were all damaged. Families are trying to, I mean, they were happy to see us last Saturday, and because we took our volunteers with U-Hauls full of boxes of fruits and vegetables, and people need water. People need more food. People need more, you know, household products, because a lot of it was damaged. And right now, the Coachella Valley is in its place where there's very little work because the heat, a lot of the work is not done. And it only starts like in September or October. So people are all employed. We have many thousands and thousands of families here that are also undocumented, but they're, because of that, they're very afraid to be able to get some support. And only seeing faces like us, seeing, and because we're known in the community, they come out of their homes and they're able to also help out, to help distribute.
Well, let's end on the note of how to help. And Melissa, I'll go to you. If there are people listening to us talk and they want to offer some sort of assistance to the farm workers of the Coachella Valley, what should they do? What can they do?
I think we definitely would love for people to you know, if they are in a position to help, if they can donate to us in different ways. I think funds would be great for us to also get supplies out to people. I remember this past Saturday when Millie mentioned that we were riding along in different U-Hauls, we were also getting water. I mean, we got pallets of water out to folks, but that's also the number one thing that I also heard is a lot of people need water. We also tried to get supplies of like batteries, tarps, and all sorts of stuff. So we would love for people to definitely help us financially to be able to kind of get supplies out to all these families because, they just needed so much help. They can follow and support the work of Alianza Nacional de Campesinas and also Lideres Campesinas to really kind of keep informed with what's going on over there. Also, for if people have in-kind donations, we have a community space in East Hollywood. So if people are interested in donating hygiene supplies, anything that they feel like they would like to support the farm workers with, they can reach out to us at Polo's Pantry, and we will be able to, you know, to receive their donations, and we can drive it over to Coachella.
We've been speaking to Millie Trevino-Sauceda of Alianza Nacional de Campesinas and Melissa Acevedo of Polo's Pantry. Thank you both for joining us here today. You can find out more about how to support their groups on our website. That's kcrw.com/GLA.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And coming up on Greater LA, how did Orange County and the city of Santa Ana in particular take the lead in making August Chicano Heritage Month? And what's its importance for Southern California's Mexican-American community? That's ahead on Greater LA. I'm Saul Gonzalez in for Steve Chiatakis, and we've got more for you now on Greater LA. There's a push for August to be federally recognized as Chicano Heritage Month, that to celebrate the history and legacy of Mexican Americans. And the city that started it all was Orange County's own Santa Ana. In 2021, Santa Ana was the first major city in the U.S. to declare August as Chicano Heritage Month. This year, Orange County followed suit, making it the first county in the country to give Chicanos that recognition. Los Angeles Times columnist Gustavo Arellano joins us now to talk about it. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Saul.
Okay, so why August for Chicano Heritage Month? What's the importance of this particular spot on the calendar?
It's kind of timing and kind of symbolic. So obviously from mid-September to mid-October is Hispanic Heritage Month all across the United States, where we celebrate all the contributions that people from the humongous diaspora of Latin America have contributed to the United States. So the motivation for Santa Ana is like they wanted to specifically honor Mexican Americans, who represent still a pretty big majority of Latinos in the United States and a supermajority in Orange County, about 75% of the population. And the reason for August then, though, is because it's tied to arguably the man who had the most profound meditation on the term Chicano and what is a Chicano, my predecessor at the Los Angeles Times as a columnist, the late Ruben Salazar.
Sure. And is there a particular importance for certain areas of Orange County to have this month as, you know, officially as Chicano Heritage Month? I'm thinking, you know, North Orange County, for instance, Santa Ana, but also Anaheim and so on.
Oh my God, the entire county. I mean, the very idea that Orange County, California, the supervisors passed a resolution that marks anything as Chicano anything is just so revolutionary. And look, it's very easy to hate on Orange County. I hate on Orange County all the time, but there's also been many important battles fought in Orange County, desegregation battles, food battles, so like legal battles that have influenced Los Angeles and the rest of the United States. So I just think it's cool that before LA County, before San Diego, San Francisco, even Texas, it's Orange County that designated Chicano Heritage Month.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of the Chicano movement in this country and in this region. And to me, well, what springs to mind to me immediately is the 1960s and how the Chicano civil rights movement was kind of on the same track as the larger civil rights movement. What were Mexican Americans fighting for back then?
the same thing we're fighting for today, better access to education, better access to jobs, housing equity, against racism, immigration rights, all of that. And, just to remind listeners, the term Chicano itself, it was a pejorative. It dates back to the 1920s, and it was seen as a pejorative. In the 1960s, you had students reclaim it as a point of pride, saying we're not going to be discriminated against anymore, and we're not going to be made to feel ashamed of who we are. And the term actually fell out of favor. We call ourselves everything, of course. Are we Hispanic today, Latino, Latinx? But now you have a younger generation, it's really interesting, of Mexican-Americans once again reclaiming the term and saying, I am Chicano, I am Chicana, I am Chicanx. It's really interesting. And it's not something I ever thought would happen again, because my generation, we called ourselves Mexican.
Yeah. But you hear that word coming out of the mouths of 20-year-olds now, right? Or teens.
Oh, yeah. You see it on social media. You see a lot of people. There's this thirst for history. The civil rights movements, the Pachucos, the Zoot Suit Riots, lowriders, the food, the style, the fashion. I do think social media has a lot to do with it. And I think for the veteranos, the old school folks, they're very proud to be able to tell the stories of those struggles of the 60s and 70s.
Let's pivot back to the present day. Congressman Lou Correa is pushing Congress to federally declare August as Chicano Heritage Month on the federal level. How did that fight begin and how's it going?
So Lou, it's kind of all connected, because the city of Santa Ana, when they announced it in 2021, the mayor at the time was Vince Sarmiento, and he's now an Orange County supervisor. And Vince is very good friends with Lou Correa, who used to be, state senator here in Orange County. And he's originally from Anaheim as well. So there is that pride. And Lou himself, he's a Chicano. He is a son of immigrants from the state of Zacatecas. He grew up in Anaheim, right in near Little People's Park, so near downtown, where there's this amazing mural from the Chicano muralist Emilio Vasquez. So Lou, it's interesting because Lou is seen very much as a centrist, cautionary guy, but he's a very proud Chicano. So to see him do that, it's like, wow, Lou, you're finally radical for the first time in your life.
And if it is adopted on the federal level, what do you think is going to be the impact? And is it possible, Gustavo, to exaggerate it? We have so many different kinds of months and weeks and days now. Do you think having a Chicano Heritage Month on a national level, or even there in Orange County, does it move the needle in any way when it comes to practical change?
At the very least, it's bringing back the term Chicano. It makes people ask, what is a Chicano? And that's literally how Ruben Salazar started his very first column, a legendary column that I urge everyone to see. So at the very least, you have a conversation. If you don't want to go past just thinking about that term, that's perfectly fine. But at a time where ethnic studies is so contentious, to be able to have, again, the Orange County Board of Supervisors, which has always been conservative, say, you know what? It's important to recognize this community and its contributions here in Orange County. That's really profound. And hopefully more people will want to learn that history, and then hopefully want to learn about their own history. Everyone should know their own history. And in this case, it's Chicanos who are once again pushing it.
All right. We've been speaking to Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times and a regular contributor here on Greater LA. Gustavo, muchas gracias.
Gracias.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, raves have historically been a pretty white musical space, even though electronic dance music has its roots in Black culture. Now, some are trying to diversify the rave scene. And we take a deep dive on sea level rise and what it means for California's coast. That's tomorrow on the show. You can check out the show anytime online at kcrw.com/GLA or on KCRW's iPhone or Android app. You can also let us know how we're doing while you're there and grab the podcast to have with you on the go. You can get the podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Celine Mendiola, Phil Richards, Sonia Geist, Danielle Chiraguayo, Carlos Ramirez, Christine Comito, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bardal all helped assemble today's episode. I'm Saul Gonzalez. See you again tomorrow.